Chapter 12, of Chrysanthus, Bishop of the Novatians at Constantinople. After the death of Sicinius, Chrysanthus was constrained to take upon him the episcopal office. He was the son of Marcy, the predecessor of Sicinius, and having had a military appointment in the palace at an early age, he was subsequently under Theodosius the Great made governor one of Italy, and after that Lord Lieutenant two of the British Isles, in both which capacities he elicited for himself the highest admiration. Returning to Constantinople at an advanced age, earnestly desiring to be constituted prefect of that city, he was made bishop of the Novatians against his will. For as Sicinius, when at the point of death, had referred to him as a most suitable person to occupy the see, the people, regarding this declaration as law, sought to have him ordained forthwith. Now as Chrysanthus attempted to avoid having this dignity forced upon him, Sabatius, imagining that a seasonable opportunity was now afforded him of making himself master of the churches, and making no account of the oath by which he had bound himself, three procured his own ordination at the hands of a few insignificant bishops. For among these was Hermogenes, who had been excommunicated with curses by Sabatius himself on account of his blasphemous writings. But this perjured procedure of Sabatius was of no avail to him, for the people, disgusted with his obstreperousness, used every effort to discover the retreat of Chrysanthus, and having found him secluded in Bithynia, they brought him back by force, and invested him with the bishopric. He was a man of unsurpassed modesty and prudence, and thus he established and enlarged the churches of the Novatians at Constantinople. Moreover, he was the first to distribute gold among the poor out of his own private property. Furthermore, he would receive nothing from the churches but two loaves of the consecrated bread five every Lord's day. So anxious was he to promote the advantage of his own church, that he drew Eulogius, the most eminent orator of that time, from the school of Troilus, and ordained him a presbyter, whose sermons are in circulation, being remarkably elegant and full of point. But Eulogius was afterwards promoted to the bishopric of the Church of the Novatians at Nicaea, where he also taught rhetoric at the same time. Chapter 13, Conflict between the Christians and Jews at Alexandria, and breach between the bishop Cyril and the prefect Orestes. About this same time it happened that the Jewish inhabitants were driven out of Alexandria by Cyril the bishop on the following account. The Alexandrian public is more delighted with tumult than any other people, and if at any time it should find a pretext, breaks forth into the most intolerable excesses, for it never ceases from its turbulence without bloodshed. It happened on the present occasion that a disturbance arose among the populace, not from a cause of any serious importance, but out of an evil that has become very popular in almost all cities, viz., a fondness for dancing exhibitions. One, in consequence of the Jews being disengaged from business on the Sabbath, and spending their time, not in hearing the law, but in theatrical amusements, dancers usually collect great crowds on that day, and disorder is almost invariably produced. And although this was in some degree controlled by the governor of Alexandria, nevertheless the Jews continued opposing these measures. And although they are always hostile toward the Christians, they were roused to still greater opposition against them on account of the dancers. When therefore Orestes the prefect was publishing an edict, for so they are accustomed to call public notices, in the theatre for the regulation of the shows, some of the bishop Cyril's party were present to learn the nature of the orders about to be issued. There was among them a certain Hierax, a teacher of the rudimental branches of literature, and one who was a very enthusiastic listener of the bishop Cyril's sermons, and made himself conspicuous by his forwardness in applauding. When the Jews observed this person in the theatre, they immediately cried out that he had come there for no other purpose than to excite sedition among the people. Now Orestes had long regarded with jealousy the growing power of the bishops, because they encroached on the jurisdiction of the authorities appointed by the emperor, especially as Cyril wished to set spies over his proceedings. He therefore ordered Hierax to be seized, and publicly subjected him to the torture in the theatre. Cyril, on being informed of this, sent for the principal Jews, and threatened them with the utmost severities unless they desisted from their molestation of the Christians. The Jewish populace, on hearing these menaces, instead of suppressing their violence, only became more furious, and were led to form conspiracies for the destruction of the Christians. One of these was of so desperate a character as to cause their entire expulsion from Alexandria. This I shall now describe. Having agreed that each one of them should wear a ring on his finger made of the bark of a palm branch, for the sake of mutual recognition, they determined to make a nightly attack on the Christians. They therefore sent persons into the streets to raise an outcry that the church named after Alexander was on fire. Thus many Christians on hearing this ran out, some from one direction and some from another, in great anxiety to save their church. The Jews immediately fell upon and slew them, readily distinguishing each other by their rings. At daybreak the authors of this atrocity could not be concealed, and Cyril, accompanied by an immense crowd of people, going to their synagogues, for so they call their house of prayer, took them away from them, and drove the Jews out of the city, permitting the multitude to plunder their goods. Thus the Jews who had inhabited the city from the time of Alexander the Macedonian were expelled from it, stripped of all they possessed, and dispersed some in one direction and some in another. One of them, a physician too named Adamantius, fled to Atticus, bishop of Constantinople, and professing Christianity, some time afterwards returned to Alexandria and fixed his residence there. But Orestes, the governor of Alexandria, was filled with great indignation at these transactions, and was excessively grieved that a city of such magnitude should have been suddenly bereft of so large a portion of its population. He therefore at once communicated the whole affair to the emperor. Cyril also wrote to him, describing the outrageous conduct of the Jews, and in the meanwhile sent persons to Orestes who should mediate concerning a reconciliation, for this the people had urged him to do. And when Orestes refused to listen to friendly advances, Cyril extended toward him the book of Gospels, 3, believing that respect for religion would induce him to lay aside his resentment. When, however, even this had no pacific effect on the prefect, but he persisted in implacable hostility against the bishop, the following event afterwards occurred. Chapter 14, the monks of Nitria come down and raise a sedition against the prefect of Alexandria. Some of the monks inhabiting the mountains of Nitria, of a very fiery disposition, whom Theophilus some time before had unjustly armed against Dioscorus and his brethren, being again transported with an ardent zeal, resolved to fight in behalf of Cyril. About 500 of them therefore, quitting their monasteries, came into the city, and meeting the prefect in his chariot, they called him a pagan idolater, and applied to him many other abusive epithets. He, supposing this to be a snare laid for him by Cyril, exclaimed that he was a Christian, and had been baptized by Atticus the bishop at Constantinople. As they gave but little heed to his protestations, and a certain one of them named Ammonius threw a stone at Orestes which struck him on the head and covered him with the blood that flowed from the wound, all the guards with a few exceptions fled, plunging into the crowd, some in one direction and some in another, fearing to be stoned to death. Meanwhile the populace of Alexandria ran to the rescue of the governor, and put the rest of the monks to flight, but having secured Ammonius they delivered him up to the prefect. He immediately put him publicly to the torture, which was inflicted with such severity that he died under the effects of it, and not long after he gave an account to the emperors of what had taken place. Cyril also, on the other hand, forwarded his statement of the matter to the emperor, and causing the body of Ammonius to be deposited in a certain church, he gave him the new appellation of Thaumasius, one ordering him to be enrolled among the martyrs, and eulogizing his magnanimity in church as that of one who had fallen in a conflict in defense of piety. But the more sober-minded, although Christians, did not accept Cyril's prejudiced estimate of him, for they well knew that he had suffered the punishment due to his rashness, and that he had not lost his life under the torture because he would not deny Christ. And Cyril himself, being conscious of this, suffered the recollection of the circumstance to be gradually obliterated by silence. But the animosity between Cyril and Orestes did not by any means subside at this point, but was kindled to afresh by an occurrence similar to the preceding. Chapter 15, of Hypatia the female philosopher. There was a woman at Alexandria named Hypatia, one daughter of the philosopher Theon, who made such attainments in literature and science, as to far surpass all the philosophers of her own time. Having succeeded to the school of Plato and Plotinus, she explained the principles of philosophy to her auditors, many of whom came from a distance to receive her instructions. On account of the self-possession and ease of manner, which she had acquired in consequence of the cultivation of her mind, she not unfrequently appeared in public in presence of the magistrates. Neither did she feel abashed in coming to an assembly of men. For all men on account of her extraordinary dignity and virtue admired her the more. Yet even she fell a victim to the political jealousy which at that time prevailed. For as she had frequent interviews with Orestes, it was calumniously reported among the Christian populace, that it was she who prevented Orestes from being reconciled to the bishop. Some of them therefore, hurried away by a fierce and bigoted zeal, whose ringleader was a reader named Peter, waylaid her returning home, and dragging her from her carriage, they took her to the church called Caesareum, where they completely stripped her, and then murdered her with dials. To after tearing her body in pieces, they took her mangled limbs to a place called Cinaron, and they burnt them. This affair brought not the least opprobrium, not only upon Cyril, III, but also upon the whole Alexandrian church. And surely nothing can be farther from the spirit of Christianity than the allowance of massacres, fights, and transactions of that sort. This happened in the month of March during Lent, in the fourth year of Cyril's episcopate, under the tenth consulate of Honorius, and the sixth of Theodosius. 4. Chapter 16. The Jews commit another outrage upon the Christians and are punished. Soon afterwards the Jews renewed their malevolent and impious practices against the Christians, and drew down upon themselves deserved punishment. At a place named in Mestar, situated between Chalcedon and Antioch in Syria, the Jews were amusing themselves in their usual way with a variety of sports. In this way they indulged in many absurdities, and at length, impelled by drunkenness, they were guilty of scoffing at Christians and even Christ himself, and in derision of the cross and those who put their trust in the crucified one. They seized a Christian boy, and having bound him to a cross, began to laugh and sneer at him, but in a little while becoming so transported with fury, they scourged the child until he died under their hands. This conduct occasioned a sharp conflict between them and the Christians, and as soon as the emperors were informed of the circumstance, they issued orders to the governor of the province to find out and punish the delinquents, and thus the Jewish inhabitants of this place paid the penalty for the wickedness they had committed in their impious sport. Chapter 17. Miracle performed by Paul, Bishop of the Novatians, at the baptism of a Jewish impostor. About this time Chrysanthus, Bishop of the Novatians, after presiding over the churches of his own sect 7 years, died on the 26th of August, under the consulate of Monaxius and Plintha. One, he was succeeded in the bishopric by Paul, who had formerly been a teacher of the Latin language, but afterwards, setting aside the Latin language, had devoted himself to an ascetic course of life, and having founded a monastery of religious men, he adopted a mode of living not very different from that pursued by the monks in the desert. In fact, I myself found him just such a person as Evagrius II says the monks dwelling in the deserts ought to be, imitating them in continued fastings, silence, abstinence from animal food, and for the most part abstaining also from the use of oil and wine. He was, moreover, solicitous about the wants of the poor to as great an extent as any other man. He untiringly visited those who were in prison, and in behalf of many criminals interceded with the judges, who readily attended to him on account of his eminent piety. But why should I lengthen my account of him? For I am about to mention a deed done by him which is well worthy of being recorded in writing. A certain Jewish impostor, pretending to be a convert to Christianity, was in the habit of being baptized often three, and by that artifice he amassed a good deal of money, after having deceived many of the Christian sects by this fraud, for he received baptism from the Arians and Macedonians, as there remains no others to practice his hypocrisy upon. He at length came to Paul, Bishop of the Novatians, and declaring that he earnestly desired baptism, requested that he might obtain it at his hand. Paul commended the determination of the Jew, but told him he could not perform that rite for him until he had been instructed in the fundamental principles of the faith, and given himself to fasting and prayer for many days. For the Jew compelled to fast against his will became the more importunate in his request for baptism. Now, as Paul did not wish to discourage him by longer delays, since he was so urgent, consented to grant his request, and made all the necessary preparations for the baptism. Having purchased a white vestment for him, he ordered the font to be filled with water, and then led the Jew to it in order to baptize him. But a certain invisible power of God caused the water suddenly to disappear. The bishop, of course, and those present, had not the least suspicion of the real cause, but imagined that the water had escaped by the channels underneath, by means of which they are accustomed to empty the font. These passages were therefore very carefully closed, and the font filled again. Again, however, as the Jew was taken there a second time, the water vanished as before. Then Paul, addressing the Jew, said, "Either you are an evildoer, wretched man, or an ignorant person who has already been baptized." The people having crowded together to witness this miracle, one among them recognized the Jew, and identified him as having been baptized by Atticus, the bishop, a little while before. Such was the portent wrought by the hands of Paul, bishop of the Novatians. Chapter 18, Renewal of Hostilities Between the Romans and Persians After the Death of Adigdes, King of the Persians. Adigdes, King of the Persians, who had in no way molested the Christians in his dominions, having died, one his son Varanes by name succeeded him in the kingdom. This prince, yielding to the influence of the Magi, persecuted the Christians, though with rigor, by inflicting on them a variety of Persian punishments and tortures. They were therefore, on account of the oppression, obliged to desert their country and seek refuge among the Romans, entreating them not to suffer them to be completely extirpated. Atticus the bishop received these suppliants with great benignity, and did his utmost to help them in whatsoever way it was possible. Accordingly, he made the emperor Theodosius acquainted with the facts. It happened at the same time that another grievance of the Romans against Persians came to light. The Persians, that is to say, would not send back the laborers in the gold mines who had been hired from among the Romans, and they also plundered the Roman merchants. The bad feeling which these things produced was greatly increased by the flight of the Persian Christians into the Roman territories. For the Persian king immediately sent an embassy to demand the fugitives, but the Romans were by no means disposed to deliver them up, not only as desirous of defending their suppliants, but also because they were ready to do anything for the sake of the Christian religion, for which reason they chose rather to renew the war with the Persians than to suffer the Christians to be miserably destroyed. The league was accordingly broken, and a fierce war followed, two of which war I deem it not unseasonable to give some brief account. The Roman emperor first sent a body of troops under the command of the general Ardaberius, three who making an eruption through Armenia into Persia, ravaged one of its provinces called Azazn. Narses the Persian general marched against him with the Persian army, but on coming to an engagement he was defeated, and obliged to retreat. Afterwards he judged it advantageous to make an unexpected eruption through Mesopotamia into the Roman territories there unguarded, thinking by this means to be revenged on the enemy. But this design of Narses did not escape the observation of the Roman general. Having therefore plundered Azazn, he then himself also hastily marched into Mesopotamia. Wherefore Narses, although furnished with a large army, was prevented from invading the Roman provinces, but arriving at Nisibis, a city in the possession of the Persians situated on the frontiers of both empires, he sent Ardaberius desiring that they might make mutual arrangements about carrying on the war, and appoint a time and place for an engagement. But he said to the messengers, "Tell Narses that the Roman emperors will not fight when it pleases him." The emperor, perceiving that the Persian was mustering his whole force, made additional levies to his army, and put his whole trust in God for the victory, and that the king was not without immediate benefit from this pious confidence the following circumstance proves. As the Constantinopolitans were in great consternation, and apprehensive respecting the issue of the war, Angels from God appeared to some persons in Bithynia who were traveling to Constantinople on their own affairs, and bade them tell the people not to be alarmed, but pray to God and be assured that the Romans would be conquerors, for they said that they themselves were appointed by God to defend them. When this message was circulated, it not only comforted the residents of the city, but rendered the soldiers more courageous. The seat of war being transferred, as we have said, from Armenia to Mesopotamia, the Romans shut up the Persians in the city of Nisibis, which they besieged, and having constructed wooden towers which they advanced by means of machines to the walls, they slew great numbers of those who defended them, as well as of those who ran to their assistance. When Varanes, the Persian monarch, learned that his province of Azaison on the one hand had been desolated, and that on the other his army was closely besieged in the city of Nisibis, he resolved to march in person with all his forces against the Romans, but dreading the Roman valor, he implored the aid of the Saracens, who were then governed by a warlike chief named Alamanarus. This prince accordingly brought with him a large reinforcement of Saracen auxiliaries, exhorted the king of the Persians to fear nothing, for that he would soon reduce the Romans under his power, and deliver Antioch in Syria into his hands. But the event did not realize these promises, for God infused into the minds of the Saracens a terrible panic, and imagining that the Roman army was falling upon them, and finding no other way of escape, they precipitated themselves, armed as they were, into the river Euphrates, wherein nearly 100,000 of them were drowned. Such was the nature of the panic. The Romans besieging Nisibis, understanding that the king of Persia was bringing with him a great number of elephants, became alarmed in their turn, burnt all the machines they had used in carrying on the siege, and retired into their own country. What engagements afterwards took place, and how Ariobindus, another Roman general, killed the bravest of the Persians in single combat, and by what means Ardaberius destroyed 7 Persian commanders in an ambuscade, and in what manner Vitian, another Roman general, vanquished the remnant of the Saracen forces, I believe I ought to pass by, lest I should digress too far from my subject. Chapter 19, of Palladius the Courier, how the Emperor Theodosius received intelligence of what was done in an incredibly short space of time, and how he was quickly informed of events taking place far away, I shall attempt to explain. For he had the good fortune to possess among his subjects a man endowed with extraordinary energy both of body and mind, named Palladius, who rode so vigorously that he would reach the frontiers of the Roman and Persian dominions in 3 days, one and again return to Constantinople in as many more. The same individual traversed other parts of the world on missions from the emperor with equal celerity, so that an eloquent man once said not unaptly, "This man by his speed proves the vast expanse of the Roman Empire to be little." The king of the Persians himself was astonished at the expeditious feats which were related to him of this courier, but we must be content with the above details concerning him.